Presenting a proven way to build your endowment with a sustainable gift planning program, this is the Gift Planning Development Podcast, an ongoing forum designed to help you meet all of your gift planning goals.
It's the Gift Planning Development Podcast. I'm your host today, Joe Tumalo. This podcast we designed and delivered to help fundraisers get better results. The goal of these podcasts is to inform you, educate you. That's the same thing. Inform, educate, entertain, and inspire. That's what I was looking for, inspire. So today's guest is going to talk as a guy that I've known for a long time, and he's going to talk about my favorite topic. Those of you that follow me or that have seen me speak or we've worked together, I am so much about picking up the phone, making that a daily habit, just like you wouldn't say, hey, I didn't brush my teeth today or I didn't take a shower. Well, I believe that you should never say, I didn't make any calls today to donors. And one of the biggest concerns that I hear from clients and other fundraisers is we are just too busy. We have the people out there. We just can't get to them. We're too busy. So my guest today, for quite some time, has been helping organizations figure that out by outsourcing the calling, right? That's nothing new. Outsourcing your fundraising to calling companies is not new. But Anthony Alonso is our guest today. Hello, Anthony.
Hello, Joe. Thank you for having me.
My pleasure. So that as a concept is nothing new, but what you have done in the many years, and I would say you are the leader, if I may be so bold. You are paying me for this, right?
I am.
You are the leader in using the telephone to qualify donors around planned giving. What? Right? People say, what? How can you do that? Were you crazy? You mean an outsider is going to talk to my donors about something as personal as planned giving? Get out of town. No way, man. Right? That was how many years ago were people saying that to you and me?
Interestingly enough, I still get it, Joe. And it was, you know, if I'm being honest, it was my first reaction when I had a client approach me about doing this. And I've been doing this for, you know, as you know, Joe, I had hair when I started for 30 some years. And that was my first reaction, being someone who had managed highly personalized phone programs for annual giving, capital campaign wrap up. I said, wow, planned giving, no, that's too personal, phone call. Can't do that over the phone. So that was my gut reaction right away. And then I started thinking about the fundamentals of fundraising, which is, you know, if this was a face-to-face solicitation, what would you do? You know, and then how do you use the mass communication tools of mail and phone and now email and social media to personalize the process? And what resulted over the years was various attempts with other companies that did planned giving work down to the process that we have in place today at Catapult. But, you know, I want to say that it's a process that everybody could use in their own shops. You don't have to outsource it.
Yeah. And so your company now is your co-founder of Catapult Fundraising. How'd you come up with Catapult? What does that mean?
Well, we tossed around a lot of ideas. The company was formed in 2016, and it was a merger of two companies, a capital campaign consulting firm called One to One, and my old firm, which had been known for 25 years as Advantage Plus Consulting, which did highly personalized phone programs. We merged into Catapult, and myself and my co-founder, Diane Carlson, were tossing around ideas, you know, frankly, at P.F. Chang's over vodka, if I'm being honest. And what we talked about is how we wanted to form a company that would catapult donors to the next level, because we really considered what we do all about creating pipeline and all about taking donors to the next level, mid-level donors to become major gift prospects, low-end donors to become mid-level donors. So that's how the name originated.
That's clever. Very clever. And so so we don't lose the point about the big objection. Well, yeah, again, like you said, thank you. This is not just about talking about how great you are for 45 minutes, although we could go much longer than that, talking about how great you are, but also to help people use the phone more efficiently. But I want to, before we leave that point about outsourcing, and the main objection is, how the heck could we ever have an outsider talk about, you know, call our donors and have a conversation that personal. You and I know it works. We've seen it. We've seen it work in there's a small independent school who I won't mention, but you know, that was their big objection. This is no way. We're a small boarding school and we're going to have outsiders call. So what's your response to people that express that concern?
Well, you and I have worked together in the past on in a variety of capacities, helping clients. I think, you know, the simple response is if you hire a plan giving director and they come into work for you, they're an outsider too. Unless you go out and hire an alum that specializes in plan giving, they're an outsider. So they need to be trained. They need to understand your mission. They need to understand your case. So fundamentally, it's not having an outsider. It's having a well, you know, and I don't like to use the word trained. I like to use the word educated, because I think we spend a lot of time training nowadays, but not educating people on the why. You know, we talk about the how, but the why. Why are we doing this? Why is it important to this organization? And that's, you can achieve that if you have a company that you outsource to who partners with you. In our particular case, we use callers to close gifts over the phone that have 20 plus years experience in plan giving. All of our callers have 20 plus years experience in plan giving. So it would be like hiring an extension to your development team. These are folks who are well-versed in plan giving, who are learning your case, your mission, and getting behind that and rallying behind it. It sounds trite, but I always say it's all about the caller. You know, it's all about that caller. And you know that. I think one of the interesting things that we should probably delve into, and I know that you and I discussed, you know, chatting about different things in this podcast, is what's going on today with the pandemic and whether we should be out soliciting right now and soliciting for planned gifts. And I'd love to hear your thoughts on that.
Well, thank you. I'm just going off of anecdotal information and a couple articles. There was one, I think, in the Journal of Philanthropy a couple weeks ago. There's a company kind of like LegalZoom where people can go and have their will drafted, and business is booming. Donors are, I guess, aware of their mortality and how fragile life is. And then I have my friend David Toll, who works with me, former state attorney, and he still keeps in touch with some attorneys, and they are busier than ever because people are redoing their estate plans. So, you know, probably seeing some of my stuff, my favorite expression, and I use it all the time, ad nauseum, if you will, is don't make decisions for your donors.
Indeed. Indeed. Right? And that's why I brought that up and asked you the question, because I think there's a lot of fear about asking, especially when it comes to plan giving. And that's why we're seeing the flattening of plan giving when it comes to Giving USA. Giving USA just put out their latest book and findings on last year's giving. And what we saw was that plan giving was flat compared to other giving. Yet, you know, this wealth transfer that when you and I started 20 years ago, Joe, you know, they talked about this is coming in 20 years. That's happening right now. You know, the estimates are that between $1 and $2 trillion is going to be passed on each year. So there's a real opportunity right now. And I think we're making decisions for our donors, and we're simply not asking. And that's why getting on the phones, which is the point you alluded to at the beginning of this podcast, is so critical. You know, we've been telling our clients during this pandemic that they should be making at least 5 phone calls before 10 a.m. every single day. They do that, they're reaching out to 25 donors a week. And think about how many of us actually do that. And I know you're a big advocate for that. I am too. You know, the notion that telemarketing is dead, which you and I have heard for many years, Joe, is just not true. The problem that's occurred in the market over the years is that telemarketing has become all about automated dialers, all about getting through prospects as quickly as possible, instead of fundamentally what phones should be about. And that's having conversations like you and I are having here.
Beautiful. Beautiful. A couple things I want to unpack there that you just said. So generally, let's maybe pre-COVID, on average, how many, as a company, how many calls would you say you guys were making a month, roughly, ballparkish?
Well, as you know, we call for annual giving. We call for a lot of different things. Yeah. Are you talking specifically about plan giving or?
No, everything. Just total, all giving, all your employees, all the callers, on an average.
Probably about 100,000 a month.
Wow. 100,000 donors or people?
probably about 100,000, not all donors, some acquisition, but roughly about 100,000 calls a month.
Wow. All right. So I would say you're an expert in calling. So just, I mean, you could have just, you could have faked your resume. How do I know? So, but that validates, right? So based on that, Anthony, may I call you Anthony?
Absolutely.
Well, you always make me call you Mr. Alonso every time I see you in public. So I didn't want to.
Listen, you always call me Double A.
Double A, that's right.
Double A.
A to the second power. That's your DJ name. So based on that volume, what happened March and April and May? What's going on? Where are you guys? Are you doing less volume? Or are you able to draw any conclusions about the reception? Or I'm sure.
We can. Yeah, we can. We had to pivot, as most companies did, because there was a shutdown here in Nevada. And so one of the things that we kept telling clients is we can't stop fundraising. You know, fundraising is about your donor, and you got to let your donor decide what they want to do. One of the things that we've seen traditionally, crisis after crisis, whether you look at 9/11, whether you look at the financial crisis, is that giving didn't go down. Donor loyalty shifted. The donor loyalty shifted in large part because people were afraid to ask and stopped asking. Now, the only time we've traditionally seen giving go down historically has been when there's been big changes to the tax code, not when there's been big crises in this country. And so we advised our clients that they needed to continue to solicit and continue to call donors and let donors decide. Now you need to pivot. I always like to say that, you know, you and I and those people listening, I assume on this podcast, get to get up every day and know what we're doing is having an impact on people's lives. You know, what a great place to be, right, Joe? I mean, compared to other people in this country who are not doing that kind of meaningful work, right? And so we need to be loyal to our donors. We talk about donors being loyal to us. I think we need to be loyal to our donors. And what that means to us is letting them make decisions, telling them what kind of impact we're having. So we very quickly shifted to talking about the impact that the nonprofit clients we had were having during this COVID pandemic. Because if you look at most nonprofits across the country, they were all impacted in some way, and they all had to quickly pivot. You know, universities had to now provide student loans to students that needed to go home. They needed to fund online courses. You know, we have a client here locally that is a battered women's shelter that had an uptick in calls because there's people at home. So nonprofits are doing things every day that are impactful, that are meaningful. So we shifted the case for support, and we quickly took our calling offline. What I mean by offline is instead of at our calling center, we pivoted to callers calling from home. What we found for those clients that chose to continue calling was an uptick in results, not a downtick, which was fascinating. Because if I'm being honest, I wasn't sure what we'd find. But my gut told me we had to keep asking. We had to keep going out there and letting the donor decide. So we saw that the participation rates pretty much stayed the same. The average gift sizes stayed the same. But we saw a huge uptick in reach rate, as you can imagine, Joe, because people were home. So we saw dollars going up for all of our clients, you know. And then there was quite a bit of clients that decided to put their programs on pause and are now having to play catch up. And the problem with putting your programs on pause during that time was that donors might have decided to give elsewhere. And that's where the shifting of loyalty comes in, donor loyalty to other nonprofits, perhaps. Because they're no longer being asked by the nonprofit that they're loyal to and they support. So that was a very long-winded answer, so I apologize for that. But
No. It's all right.
I feel passionate about it, as you can tell.
Yeah, I love the passion. And it's very relevant. One of the most common questions I get from people is, how do you deal with the phone with people with, I mean, I have it on my phone, I will confess, RoboKiller app on my phone. Mm-hmm. And people are, obviously, it's not like the old days when there were things called landlines, house phones. So and I always say, have a process. So that process includes number of attempts, different types of attempts. If voicemail. So attempt number one could be voicemail. Attempt number two, email. Attempt number three, call. you don't get anybody. Attempt number four, call, don't get anybody. Attempt number five. Can you talk a little bit about, again, because you guys are doing such volume, how are you connecting with people? Do you see a decline in reach rate? And, you know, how many attempts are you making? I've been telling people 10, 15 attempts, and they look at me like I'm from another galaxy.
You probably are from another galaxy.
Well, yeah.
I've known you for years. but you're right on in terms of number of attempts. But fundamentally, if I could go back to what you started with, in terms of the robocall apps that are out there and all these new technologies that are out there to make sure that you can't get through, it's simple. Stop using automated equipment to make phone calls. You know, I say this all the time. We're not selling vacuum cleaners here. We're calling our family members, our donors. And so when you're calling your family members, you don't have them, you know, say, get on the phone, say hello three times before you get on and butcher their name. You know, that's not the way real people communicate with real people. So there's been this whole thrust over the last 10, 15 years of quantity over quality. So segment, decide which prospects are the best prospects to call and call them manually. Dial the phone. Don't use automated equipment to make those phone calls. I, as you know, Joe, from having visited my site over the years, my calling facilities, I don't like automated dialers. I don't like predictive dialers. Those help the company that you're outsourcing to. They do not help the institution. So we see all the time when we start working with a client that's been using a competitor that uses these type of predictive dialers to make calls, that we triple what they raise. And it's not necessarily an average gift size or in pledge rate or a number of planned gifts that we secure, but it's in the sheer volume of people we reach. And you set a plan. We have a plan. We do 15 to 20 calling attempts for donors.
Wow.
You know, then we do 12 calling attempts for lapsed donors. You know, there's all sorts of idiosyncrasies in there in terms of whether they're lapsed 1 year to lapsed 5 year. And then we do 10 calling attempts for long lapsed 5+ years. And then for non-donors, we do 5 to 7 calling attempts to reach them. Why do we do that? Because we're segmenting. That's the way we should really be using technology, you know, to segment so that we're reducing our cost of acquisition by doing less calling attempts at the bottom end and maximizing our return by doing more calling attempts at the higher end, and further segmenting so that we have the right person doing the asking to the right person the right way. And that's critical too. And that's been lost over the last decade or so in any type of telefundraising. There should be a pre-call letter sent ahead of a phone call. It should be a heartwarming story from the donor's perspective, not the institutional perspective. It's a very different story that's being told when a donor's saying, this is why I give back. This is how this institution has impacted my life or the lives of those who I love. This is why I believe it's important and why I ask you to join me. That letter legitimizes the phone call. The caller's able to have a conversation.
I have you guys tested pre-call letter versus no pre-call letter? Because that's another common question I get from people.
Yeah, we have. We've tested it over the last 30 years multiple times. And every single time, without fail, the average gift using the pre-call letter is anywhere between 20 and 40% higher. That's a significant difference.
Wow.
And the reason being that you're letting the prospect know that a phone call is coming. You're telling a story and presenting the case in that letter, if you're doing it right. And you're presenting a specific ask amount, which has been thought out and is coming from a peer. So it changes the dynamic of the call, Joe. You know, the caller is now calling to follow up on this letter, you know, from Jane or John Smith. And so rather than the typical icebreaker in telemarketing calls, which you've all heard, which starts off with, how are you today? If you're outsourcing, you know, I always say that's a very disingenuous question. And if you want to get a telemarketer off the phone, when they ask you, how are you today, tell them. Spend the next 20 to 30 minutes telling them how your day went. They'll hang up on you because they need to get to the next call. The reason that they use that is because they need an icebreaker. If you're using a pre-call letter, the icebreaker is, I'm calling in reference to a letter that was sent to you from John or Jane Smith. Did you receive that letter? I did. What did you think about what Jane or John Smith had to say in the letter? So that becomes a conversation rather than your typical scripted telemarketing call. Nobody likes having a script written to them. And technology, I'm not saying technology shouldn't be used. It should. Should be used for segmentation to make sure that if you're a hospital, you're sending out different letters to folks who have been grateful patients who have been at different departments within your hospital. If you're a university, you might want to look at different schools and different degrees and have different letters based on that. You know, even graduation clusters, you know, and I say clusters instead of decades, because folks who graduated, for example, in the late 60s have more in common with those who graduated in the early 70s than they do with the whole decade of the 70s. So you have to be careful when you look at those clusters. You might also want to look at historical clusters within the university or the college if you're working on that. But those are the kind of segmentation things that you should be doing with technology rather than just throwing them into an automated dialer, you know, which is going to reach you 20-25% of the people. And that's why we're hearing that telemarketing is dead. You know, I always, when I speak live, I ask the audience, how many of you use telemarketing in your day-to-day activities as a fundraiser? And you have one poor guy in the back, you know, of a room filled with 70 people raise their hand. And I look at the audience and I say, the rest of you are lying. You know why I say that? You know why I say that, Joe?
No.
Because every single day when we go into work and we make an appointment to speak to a donor, we call a donor to thank them. We're a good fundraiser. We're doing all these things, right? Mm-hmm. We call a donor to solicit them. We're using telemarketing. So it's not a matter of whether we use telemarketing. It's how we use it.
Mm. Well said. I still do a fair amount of telephone work. I have a longstanding client, Salesian Missions. Actually, I think I was able to find them through one of your former level two callers, some of the folks that were doing some level two plan giving calls for you. So almost 5 years now, they've outsourced the major frontline major in plan giving officer program. It's myself and my colleague Liz up in Boston, Liz Kahn. And so pretty much all, I work for them, it averages out a little over a day a week. And pretty much all the work I do, 98% of it, is strictly what your people do, is calling. I have a pool of donors that I've cultivated over the years, but still, and because of my, just it's in my DNA to really increase the quantity and quality of the calls. And increasing the quality, I mean, I've gotten my quantity up, but really focusing on the quality. And one of the things that I'm testing and fascinated by is the power of the pause. So to your earlier point, typical robocaller, untrained telemarketer, when you pick up the phone, of course, well, if it's predictive dialing, you hear the 2 second delay, right?
Right.
And then, like you said, they're off. They're throwing up verbally all over you. You can't get a word in edgewise. I had a guy recently and I was like, whatever his name was, Dave. And he's talking, I said, Dave, slow down. Would you like to have a conversation? I'm happy to have a conversation with you because I have empathy, because I kind of do what you do. Let's just have a conversation. And he didn't know what to say. He was like, stammer. Anyway.
You didn't know where to go.
Right. And it's not their fault. I always say that. It's not their fault. They're not trained or educated, to your point. So,
educated.
Yeah. So I'm always thinking, what can I do? Because that's my competition, right? So what can I do to stand apart from every other call they're getting? No one is pausing that I know of. So it's fascinating because I used to be afraid to pause because I thought it would give people a reason to hang up. Mm-hmm. But it's the opposite. And like, so I'll introduce myself, Joe at Salesian Missions, pause. And then I use a line, did I catch you in the middle of something urgent? Pause. You know, really slow and deliberate. Now, if I'm talking to a younger, busy executive, doesn't work as well, but especially in plan giving, when I'm talking to retired people who aren't, for the most part, are not rushed, it's really powerful. Mm-hmm. And so even throughout the first 3 to 5 minutes, there's a lot of pausing. It's fascinating. People, it's only my theory. I don't have any, it's all anecdotal. I don't have any quantitative data on it. But I just feel like people aren't used to it. It throws people off. And I'm always urging my clients and audiences, when you're making these calls to people that are not expecting your call, and maybe you don't have a relationship with that well, it's counterintuitive, but put in lots of pauses and leave air, leave open space, and dominate the listening, as my friend Bruce says, dominate the listening.
Absolutely. I know what you do, and you do it well, Joe. So, and I think you're right on. I've trained callers, whether they be university students or our own callers, for 30 years now. And I've always said that the most important job that they have is to listen to the prospect. Listen. Over the years, I've seen too many callers who argue with themselves. They'll ask the prospect a question, and instead of pausing, they'll assume the prospect didn't agree with them, and they'll go, well, there's also this opportunity.
Yes. Right?
And they're selling against themselves, and I always make the say, he who speaks first loses. Hmm. If you pose the question to a potential donor, give them an opportunity to answer it. Don't answer it for them. That pause you're talking about. Wait for them, because you don't know what the prospect is thinking. They may be thinking, how does this fit into my estate plan? How does this, I've never thought of this. Let me give it a second. This is new to them. This is what you do every day. One of the things that I said yesterday, I did a webinar, was that, for the person closing the gift, that's the destination, right? That's our job, right? Mm-hmm. You got to realize that for the donor, you've got to look at their desired destination, right? And Michael Rosen, who a lot of folks on here know, always says that. And that stuck with me over the years because I think he's right. What's the donor's desired destination? And so our job on any phone call, I believe truly has to be to leave everyone we speak to feeling good about the institution. Whether they say yes, no, or maybe is irrelevant. Because if we do that effectively as fundraisers, the money will follow. May not be on the call you just made, Joe. Maybe in a month, maybe in a year, but the money will follow. It's about building that relationship. And you can't do that by reading a script to someone, which is what this whole business has become. It's become about reading scripts rather than having conversations with people. And I've gotten the same thing you've gotten, where somebody gets on the phone and I have sympathy for them, but they won't let me get a word in edgewise.
Yeah,
it's always a lot of fun, right?
Well, it's the caller is making it their agenda. It's the donor's agenda. So I'll even say, like, if I'm doing acquisition calls, I'll let them know this is a fundraising call. It's like acknowledging nobody wants to get these calls. I don't like getting them. And so right. I think it's about donor or prospect, I should say, empathy. And depending on, after doing it a while, you get the sensitivity of, even if the donor just, or the prospect says just one or two words or sentences, you kind of know pretty much how the call is going to go. So depending on the situation, the response I get, I'll let people know this is a fundraising call. And the last thing you probably want today is someone to call you to ask you for money. It's like, I just acknowledge it. Let's get it out, the elephant in the room. This is the reality. I get it. I have empathy. I don't like getting the calls either, but I think I might have something that you really could benefit by. I'm not sure, obviously, because we haven't spoken. And so I'm really calling initially just to find out if this is something that would be of interest, that would be helpful, that you would find, depending if you and your wife are charitable and you like to donate, whatever sector we're in, is something that's important for you supporting. So it's like acknowledging up front. I'm not lying. I'm not saying I'm not calling Esther for money, although I don't really technically do that. That's all they're thinking. But my rambling now is just acknowledge the fact and have donor empathy that, yeah, this is a call. I know you're not expecting my call, and it's a fundraising call. It's really, again, I'm testing it and tweaking the language as I go along. Just to see how people respond to that. That's different. Nobody's doing that. Not that I don't mean to sound like I'm a pioneer, but most outsourced calling companies are not doing that.
No, and it's a shame. I know that's coming from someone who is doing it, and we're one of the few firms left in the country that does it, and I shouldn't want more competition, but you're absolutely right. Firms are not doing that because it's expensive to do it that way. The cheaper version is to get through names as quickly as possible in a predictive dialing environment. Mm. I know our mission, I know my vision, and I just won't do that kind of fundraising. I always say, if what you want is a firm to send 10,000 names to, say, call them in 3 weeks and then send us a file back, we're the wrong firm. There's lots of companies that do very good work doing that and are very inexpensive. That's not what we do. You know, I'm a fundraiser at heart, and I always, again, going back to what I said at the beginning of this podcast, fundamentally ask myself, if this was a face-to-face solicitation, what would we do? And then how do you use the mass instruments of mail, phone, email, digital, text, even, to accomplish that goal and personalize the appeal, you know? And getting back to the topic of the plan giving call, you know, we do a two-tiered process, as you know, Joe, where we have callers at our call center that are all mature callers. I used to call them old Joe, but then I got old. What happened to us? now I call them mature with life experience.
Nice.
And their job is to simply thank the donor right after that letter that I spoke about gets sent. Thank the donor for their many years of loyal giving, to identify interest in having further conversation in plan giving. And then that call gets handed off to what we call, and you alluded to, our level two or tier two caller, which are all folks with 20 plus years plan giving experience. They then take those calls. They become an extension of our client's development team and are able to close the gift over the phone and then follow up with a will confirmation form or trying to get a copy of the page of the will that mentions the institution. So trying to quantify that gift to the institution. So the institution now benefits from having 4 or 5 plan giving directors, additional plan giving directors, without having to pay for a plan giving director. You know, and the end of the result of that is typically from 1,000 prospects that were not on the radar, for every 1,000 prospects not on the radar. What I mean by that is folks who, you know, are not already assigned prospects to your major gift officers and are in the face-to-face funnel, so to speak. These are folks who have given to the institution for $100 a year for 20 years, 15 years, or $50 a year for 15, 20 years. We're generating about 1.2 to 1.5 million on average in closed, confirmed, quantified gifts from folks that are not on the radar. And the beauty of it when I see this, and that's the average, is that, you know, we're getting $5 million gifts sometimes, $1 million gifts, because of the power of asking. And I think that's what we're talking about here, Joe. I know that's what you do all the time. Pick up the phone and ask. And so, you know, many clients we're seeing $5 million gifts. We're seeing that about 25% of the folks we call already have the nonprofit in their will. Can you imagine that? Nonprofit didn't know about it.
25%?
You can not. 25%. Yeah. Now you can cultivate that relationship. You could steward that relationship. And that leads to more giving now. And one of the things we know statistically now, having been doing this for 10, 15 years, Joe, is that the annual giving and capital giving of a person who identifies as a legacy giver goes up 6 to 7 times during their lifetime. During their lifetime. So there's the justification for spending more money on plan giving. And I'm interested in your thoughts, because I hear this all the time. Plan giving is really difficult. You need to understand plan giving in order to make the ask. I get that. I know you get that. What do you say to that?
Well, I said my first response is the vast majority of gifts, even for big shops, that have a number of gift planning professionals on staff, you talk to them, the majority are still simple bequests, leave us in your will, retirement plan being the two most common. And I always say to people, not to diminish, you should have, first of all, I believe plan giving is everyone's business, and that every donor could potentially be a plan giving donor, and that we should offer plan giving at the same time we're offering every other type of giving, you know, giving through cash, pledges, deferred gifts, and that gift officers don't need to be tax experts. I'm not a tax expert, and I make my living in this business. You should have a general sense, but you don't have to go that deep, and it's rare that any of us that do this for a living, really, it depends on the shop. Of course, if you're working for the Nature Conservancy, maybe you're at the headquarters and you're dealing with a lot of gifts of land and whatnot, that's different. But for the most of the nonprofits, most of your activity is these simple beneficiary gifts or gift annuities, which are pretty simple. Once you have the right backup. So yeah, it's and that, but that's what stops people. The big thing, and I've been using this in our marketing and advertising, is people don't know how to bring in cash gifts and planned gifts at the same time. They think it's either or.
Because they're afraid. They're afraid of the planned gift. And
And they're afraid of not going to get the cash.
That's right.
You know, and what are you talking about all these planned gifts for? We may not even get them. And if we do get them, we're not going to get them for 30 years. Well, to your point about the stats, right? About it helps increase outright giving. Yeah.
It does help increase outright giving. And it, you know, I would think that, and we're judged often in this field. I know a lot of people listening probably are on what we bring in today, but you know, hopefully we've taken the job that we're in because we believe in the mission, we believe in the case and the institution. And if that's the case, don't you want to see it go on beyond you, you know? And so there's a lot of reasons to ask for a planned gift. You know, not to mention that planned giving, as you know, Joe, and you and I have had this conversation many times, is a major gift of the middle class. So you really have an opportunity when you're looking at that mid-level donor, that smaller donor, to give them an opportunity to make a major impact on the organization by making a planned gift, an estate gift, a bequest. And you hit the nail right on the head. You know, 85 to 90% statistically of these gifts are simple bequests, and they're given by individuals. And if we look at the stats, you know, the new stats just came out from Giving USA, $310 billion raised was by individuals, $310 billion, which really it hits at the core of planned giving, because that's what planned giving is. It doesn't come from corporations, doesn't come from foundations, it comes from individuals. But in order to get them, you have to educate them and you have to ask them.
Good stuff. And we're coming to the close here. Nice ending. Anything else that you were hoping we would cover today that
able to know? I appreciate the opportunity to be on here. I'm an advocate for this. We've now run planned giving calling programs at Catapult, you know, an advantage prior to that, its predecessor, you know, for the last 15 years, it works. Picking up the phone, having conversations works. It generates revenue. And I encourage everybody out there to do it. I'm happy, you know, with, no commitment to have conversations with anybody who wants to learn more about how they can do it themselves. You know, I'm always willing to have those conversations. So.
Well, you're very generous. And how can people get in touch with you all?
Well, they can come to our website, which is www.catapultfr.com. Email me at anthony@catapultfr.com or call our offices at 702-508-0101. And I'm at extension 101. I'm happy to have a conversation with anybody. Even if it's to provide you with advice or guidance on how you can set up your own program, even if it's not about hiring us as a firm, because I truly believe this field is generally about building relationships.
You're a mensch. Thank you. This was a lot
of fun. I appreciate you having me on, Joe.
Yeah, this is a lot of fun, and I'm sure very, very helpful and useful for folks. This is the part where you say goodbye.
You know, that's difficult for me. I'm a fundraiser.
I know. You can't get off the phone, right?
Thank you very much. And I wish the audience well and you well. Stay safe and healthy, my friend.
Thank you for listening to the Gift Planning Development Podcast. For more information on any of the topics you've heard about today, please go to giftplanningdevelopment.com.